Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody here from Chicago, Illinois. In this podcast, we have the privilege and honor of interviewing Mr. Patrick O'Reilly. He is the co-founder and chief product officer of a company called CyberSaint Security. Thanks for your time, Patrick, and let's go ahead and get started.
My pleasure. Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for your time. Now, we kind of did some snooping on you in the background here on LinkedIn and did some Google searching on you, but how did you get started in cyber, and can you kind of tell us some of the major highlights of your career, please?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think the primary highlight of my career is that I was, in and out of consulting before I came to cyber, and I was in financial and macroeconomic modeling. So I was, going in and modeling different things and early AI systems as well. And I had the privilege of working with a lot of teams that did some very interesting things, selling sort of models to the government, models that projected, that took the oil shocks, for example, and tried to game out what the economy would look like in a couple of years. So I was, very comfortable with early AI, trigger event analysis, database neural nets, things like that. I was happy being a consultant. But I had a friend who was in cyber, and he was a CISO for a Fortune 200 company. And we went to school together, and he used to say to me all the time, you really have to take a look at the problem in cyber. He knew I was, a tinkerer of sorts, and he said, you really, really would enjoy it. And we would go surfing, and I would sort of put him off and say, no, that's not for me. But eventually I did take a look at it with him, and I was absolutely fascinated by the entire problem set in cyber, which is a large one. And I think that was part of my fascination, that there were still so many unsolved problems in cyber. My previous incarnations, some of the problems were well understood, and there were, some established methods to go about it. But I'd never really been part of, solving large problems before from a more primitive state. So that was what really pulled me in, and within a couple of months, we had funding to start building the software. So it's been quite a journey.
How did CyberSaint come about? Was it through because of that funding then, or?
Well, it was originally my buddy George, who went to school. He did a lot of pro bono cyber work, so he would go in, to charitable organizations or high schools or even colleges, and he would, do some basic cybersecurity assessment, sometimes a little pen testing, and he would do it for free. It was sort of like a sidelight. But, he had built out some methods for, running controls and working with standards that we wound up talking to one of the larger customers of his current job as CISO, and the gentleman, Dave, was very interested in building a software application in a space, you would call GRC, but it was sort of lightweight GRC, what we were entering into. And we immediately had interest from clients in manufacturing. So we got funded, and we built the first version of the software, and I think the founding of the company would be really around the time we were building the first version of the software sometime in 2017.
Okay, excellent. How did you get the name CyberSaint Security? I think I kind of get the implication, but how did that name come about? I've never heard of anything like that before, actually.
Yeah. No, and again, that was George, and George, it came out of his kind of civic mindedness and interest in the public good. He's that sort of guy. And it really had a lot to do with helping or enabling companies to improve their cyber posture, even if they were really low maturity. So he would ride in on his horse, so to speak, and slay some dragons. And his model was it was the public good that he was interested in. And there's still quite a bit of that in the company. We do pro bono work. We do often, you know, sort of consulting that we, you know, we don't charge for. There's an element of, you know, we recognize the side of cyber that is difficult, and, you know, we're here to help. So the name stuck for that reason.
Okay, excellent. Well, it's a very nice name. Now,
thank you.
Tell us more about, tell us more about the company, like where it's now and where do you plan to take it into the future?
Sure, yeah. So where we are now is really quite interesting about 6 years in. You know, we have partners in technology that, you know, are, you know, you know, have been in technology forever. You know, one of our partners is IBM, for example. So when we started, you know, we didn't necessarily aim for that, but, you know, now we've got about 40 people on staff. You know, we're actively talking about, you know, a bigger round of investment next year. We have hundreds of customers. We work with some of the most interesting companies on the planet, in my view. You know, companies that have had risk management practices in cyber going back years. We work with Booz Allen Hamilton, you know, for example, very closely. Other system integrators as well. So, and, you know, we have a very, you know, lightweight but powerful software that can take in any control framework, can automate out of cloud security postures. You know, and we're really trying to revolutionize cyber risk management, and that's, you know, we're one of the main players in that space. And even though we're small, I would say we punch above our weight a little bit. And it's because we work with so many great practitioners and companies that what we wind up producing in the software has value, you know, because these are some high maturity organizations we've worked with. And we can pass along that value to companies that may not have quite the advanced or even the resources to do it, you know. So, yeah, we're in a very fortunate position right now and right in the middle of a very, you know, a developing market, too, to some extent. You know, to cyber risk management kind of came out of integrated risk management. It's still an open question as to whether it's a discrete market itself. We are a lightweight integrated risk management product to some extent. So, you know, it's just a very exciting time because cyber risk is, it's you know, it's a top existential. If you ask any board, any C-suite, what their top three existential risks are, you know, cyber is right on that list. So it's a great thing to be able to bring value to such a thorny, sticky problem that has implications not just for individual companies, not just for individuals, but for society writ large.
Okay. Excellent. Now, as we were talking before the show started, you know, cyber risk has a lot of different meanings, different people. How do you view cyber risk, and how would you define it from your own perspective?
Yeah. You know, because I come out of a quantitative background, you know, I first define risk as it's been historically defined, right? You know, it's in terms of likelihood and impact, you know, that can be taken in any number of directions. And one of the things I've learned about cyber risk is that, you know, there are many practices out there, and it's maybe not as high maturity as the, you know, the understanding of risk in certain actuarial areas or the understanding of risk in economics. You know, it's maybe not quite as refined, but you can bring a lot of value to the conversation when you understand that different teams have a different approach. And we personally, you know, here at the company, we take a very flexible approach. You know, we like to work with the thought leaders across, you know, our economy, and we have several risk models and systems. So, you know, we're flexible with respect to that, and I honestly think that the future will involve, you know, being quite flexible around what, you know, the refinements that people put on likelihood and impact, because you can decompose those things many different ways. There's a lot of different statistical methods. There's a lot of different quantitative methods. There's a lot of modeling that can be done as well. So right now, you know, we're one of the very few products that takes a sort of, you know, a flexible and open approach to the calculation of risk. And, you know, when you talk to the largest companies on the planet, they often have some legacy practices around calculating it. But there is a common set of elements to all cyber risk that we're very interested in bringing additional value to as well. And you mentioned on our chat before we got on, dollars and cents, but the big part of it as well, you know, and actuarial data can enrich cyber data. You know, understanding the business impact of cyber has become very important as well. So money is often in the models of these days as well.
Cool. Now, do you take the qualitative variables into account too, or are you just all strictly quantitative at this point?
We do both. We started with a qualitative model that had a sort of lightweight quantitative aspect to it, and that was a model developed by NIST in their 830 series of publications. And then we went more in the direction of the statistical quantitative models like FAIR, which the Open FAIR Society advocates. And that's, it's sort of probabilistic. Runs Monte Carlo simulations as well. So it's a scenario modeling kind of risk model. And then we have hybrid versions as well, and ones that allow you to sort of go further down in the model and talk about, threat capabilities, talk about the motivations of actors, talk about the attack surface, the control strength, the primary and secondary impacts, things like that. And we've seen models with upwards of 30 or 40,000 lines of code in them as well. So
Oh, wow.
we work with all sorts of different models, really.
Wow. Okay. Excellent. Well, do you have like your own homegrown models that you kind of use as a baseline, or you just kind of create your own models ad hoc depending on what the needs of clients are?
Yeah, we don't do much ad hoc really. Because the way we got into the software business was around the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. A lot of the practice in cyber, comes out of the research that the federal government has done, and that's a rich supply of practices, methodologies, processes, and documentation for the practice of cyber. And when you talk to the top cyber practitioners on the planet, they use a lot of the open source stuff that's out there, right? And a lot of it comes out of the government. So we haven't built any ad hoc models. All our models are, refer back to one standard or another. We like to keep it that way because there are, companies that we compete against who have a more black box or ad hoc approach, who are trying to become a standard in and of themselves. But, a lot of good work has already been done in this area. And the tricky part of cyber is often, breaking down silos and wiring things up across different practices or different research groups, right? It's not so much inventing a new thing as it is finding a way to use all the brilliant insights that are out there that produces, that produces good analysis.
Okay, excellent. Well, let's do a deeper dive into two of your products, CyberStrong and CyberBase. Can you kind of get into the nuts and bolts of that, please?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we're software as a service. That said, we do have some on-premise installations. The first version of the software really ran a couple of control frameworks. It ran DFARS, and it ran the cybersecurity framework, and we related those two together, which, the government does as well. We had a lot of interest for that because DFARS was a standard that companies would have to have in place in order to do business with the federal government. But what we discovered after we had that first version out was that there were many other standards, and we knew this already, many other standards and many other companies that wanted to take advantage of a lightweight approach to, doing assessments on controls. Then we sort of, discovered one of the thornier problems in cyber is if you're working in one standard, can you use that information in another standard? Can you be more efficient in your program with respect to compliance? That's when we started to build out some NLP, which we have in the software. We trained, some NLP, a large neural network, on all the security language we could find, and we can crosswalk into standards using that NLP. That built out another area of the product. Then we put in risk. So we you know, early on we knew in our conversations with companies that the compliance function was often related to the risk functions in the company, and the future was kind of pushing, you know, compliance and risk together. And that, you know, probably what was going to happen was, you know, a regulatory body was basically going to say you need to have some form of cyber risk management in place that you socialize with your senior management or the board. And we knew that a few years ago, so we started to build out more and more risk. Again, we relate that risk back to controls. It's kind of, you know, central to the thesis that one of the ways you manage and mitigate risk is by, you know, is by your controls in system. So, you know, if you want to buy down or lessen sort of loss exposure on certain things, you can, you know, create projects to improve the, you know, to do gap remediation on your controls, and you can sort of take down risk in real time. We also got into automation as well, and that's why we work with some large technology providers, because we can take information out of the cloud and you know, for individual customers, and we can automate controls, which, you know, a lot of organizations are beginning to do now because of the speed and accuracy of, you know, that it brings to the assessment process and the improved quality of risk assessment. Risk assessment used to be more of a, you know, once a quarter or once every 6 months or once a year, and it was done on information that was old. And now, you know, we're achieving near real time in some ways with some of our leading edge customers. So the software has a lot of different components in it now. It's got the automation, it's got the risk. We have compute engines that are, you know, endpoints as well. And we try to keep the user experience as simple as possible. So we're not a software that really believes in bringing a team of consultants to implement, you know, inside a company. We're very transparent. We have, you know, a lot of material to help customers and users get onboarded. We do that quicker than most softwares. So it's very important to us that we remain, you know, intuitive and useful to the end user.
Excellent. Now, you talked about the cloud. Do you use the AWS or do you use Azure, or kind of a mix of both depending on what the client wants?
Yeah, we are, our main software is installed in AWS East Coast, you know, but we are also installed in IBM. We're also installed, you know, in Google, you know, okay. But our main customer instance that's the software as a service is in AWS. We have integrations into AWS as well for our customers, integrations into IBM, integrations into Azure, to, you know, take their data, right, in their instances on their infrastructures and update controls based on that data as well. And we work very closely with Snowflake also.
Okay, excellent. Now, you were talking about neural networks, not automation, so I have to ask you this question. Artificial intelligence, now that's being the big buzzword thrown around all over every industry. Everybody's full of job loss, this, that, you know, and
right.
I wrote a book on AI a few years ago. It came out in 2021, and I just submitted another manuscript on that. But I'm kind of interested to know, what is your take on AI in general? You know, apart from your own company and your own work, but what's your view on it? Is that going to be the end of society, or is it going to replace jobs? What do you think?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And I think we talk about it here in the shop, because, you know, I have research staff that builds AI, you know, and I work with companies that leverage AI, and, you know, I'm someone who kind of built AI, you know, and I know that one of the secrets about building AI is the AI is only as good as the data you feed it, right? And in the old days, that was a lot of work. You know, that was just a ton of work, and it wasn't very glamorous, you know, and not a lot of people in AI talked about it, you know, or publicly, right? We didn't go out and say, oh, you know, I have to build a corpus, and there's a lot of tagging and classification, and God almighty, it's just a grind, you know? But, you know, the AI, again, is only as good as what you feed it. And, you know, this debate I think that society's having about artificial general intelligence, you know, we talk about it in-house here too. Is AI capable of, you know, replacing human beings? It probably in the long run, yeah, to some extent. But I don't view it as, you know, then the human beings then become sort of dusty and you put them on a shelf. They're freed up to do other analytical tasks that maybe they're more suited for, you know. You know, the whole thing about GPT is a marvel. It's a wonder. We all work with it here at house a little bit. But it's consumer-facing. And, you know, the things it does are not necessarily all that ground-shaking for business applications at the moment. You know, I think IBM's doing a lot of great stuff with Watson. Does AI bear watching, you know? And here's the thing, too, right? I think there's an ethical concern, right, which is that in order to train big AIs, in order to have high-quality AIs, you need to deploy an immense amount of resource, right? And, you know, in order to run them, you need to have an immense amount of resource as well. Who gets to say, right, what the future looks like that way? You know, is it just the big players? And the debate right now seems a little kooky to me because we haven't really defined what artificial general intelligence looks like. We don't really define it with respect to human beings all that well either. You know, and,
right.
You know, if you ask philosophers of mind what, you know, computer science people like to talk about the Turing test, right? But if you ask philosophers of mind what a singularity would look like around consciousness, well, they're still debating that as well, you know. And that hasn't made its way into the conversation either much, right? So I'm just waiting for the conversation to advance a little beyond the hype and beyond a bunch of people showing up in front of Congress and saying it's going to, you know, consume the world, or others being like, it's harmless. You know, I don't know that we're having the right conversation about it yet.
Right. The way I view it is, I think it's just another dot-com bubble that we're going through right now. It's going to burst eventually.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to subside. AI will be here. It's not going to go away. But the way I get my perspective is, Ed was actually a professor at Purdue in spinal cord regeneration research. And so we love discussions about the human brain, and he was on the verge of a breakthrough, something on the regeneration using amniotic fluid right before he died of a heart attack. But from what he told me, is that we will, under human brain, at best we'll understand like maybe 0.5% of it. And I think where people kind of get the misnomer about AI is that it's going to totally imitate the human brain, replicate it.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it's never, ever going to happen like that. At best, it'll be used for, like, some automation processes, but it can't replace the human. It never will. And you're right. It's garbage. I mean, it's going to take human intervention to actually put all that data in, make sure it's cleansed and optimized, make sure you get the right output that you're looking for. So.
Right.
But those are just my
And, I mean, I have a practitioner's take on it. And, well, you know, it's been terribly useful in a set of really cool but limited applications, you know. I mean, and it will continue to be that. But I think you're right and your father's right, you know, that until and with, you know, if we ever are able to understand the human mind more better, you know, more thoroughly, which we don't, you know, we're not going to be able to have the conversation about, you know, artificial general intelligence on a plane where we need to understand it. We need to understand ourselves as well.
Exactly. So that's a whole different, I guess, academic, scientific, philosophical, corporate talk. Well, it'll be interesting how ChatGPT kind of, you know, fares this year and how it all kind of turns out in the end. But anyway, so back to cybersecurity risk. Do you have any client testimonials that you'd like to share with us about your products and how it's worked for them and figuring out their controls and how they've come to compliance with the various laws and all that?
Yeah. I mean, with plenty. I mean, I can send you papers as well. I can paraphrase our customers, you know, that we've, you know, doubled or tripled the efficiency of the assessment process and recontextualized the information with respect to cyber risk. and bought down a significant amount of cyber risk. The automation components, you know, I know our top customers are, you know, really excited about that, and they talk about the speed and the accuracy. I mean, a lot of cyber, you know, sort of one of the secrets of cyber is that it historically has been practiced, you know, over the phone and on spreadsheets, and that can get very, very cumbersome, very, very tiring, and you already have overtaxed professionals in cyber, you know. So insofar as you're able to automate and speed the process of assessment and contextualize that information in ways that they can show to their senior leadership, they can validate their programs, they can help the company, you know, make business-critical decisions around future investment. You know, all of our testimonials tend to focus on that.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Now, there are other cyber vendors out there, probably each and every one of them, MSPs, MSSPs, they all claim to have their own cyber risk algorithm, blah, blah, blah. And I question them, and then he goes, oh, well, we don't know what it's all about, but anyway, that's a whole different story in of itself. But what separates you from all these other cyber vendors, MSPs, MSSPs, that they claim they have their own algorithm for risk assessment?
Yeah, well, we at least a third of our customer base is MSPs and MSSPs.
Oh, really? Okay.
And yeah, and system integrators as well. So, you know, we bring you know, a unique set of capabilities to service providers that, you know, speeds up their assessment time and produces reports and visualizations around risk that are, you know, helpful for them when it comes to growing the customer lifecycle. That's really what they're obsessed with. You know, they don't always want to go in and do a one-off assessment and be kicked out the door. You know, they want to be able to work with that customer going forward, making the case around continued investment with respect to increased cyber resiliency, and we're all about that. We have a whole section of the product that is around risk remediation workflow, and it relates everything back to the top existential risks. It references actuarial data, and then it points back into the controls and the mitigations and the remediations in the controls and puts all that in a financial context so you can socialize that with business leaders. You know, I mean, that's been one of the main problems in cyber, is that it comes out of IT culture, and IT culture doesn't always speak in business terms all that well. And so IT's had to grow up a little bit with respect to cyber. So we're not really competitive when it comes to unique special sauce or any of that. We do have a lot of competitors who claim to have some unique algorithm, but most of the companies we talk to, if not all, don't buy those claims on the face of it. You know, they tend to be very skeptical with respect to some unique, algorithm or formula or insight that a software or a service provider can provide. Most practitioners are pretty smart, they're pretty savvy, and they understand that there's established ways to work in cyber, and they usually are pretty transparent. And, you know, the data, it's data quality, and it's the quality of the models that you're using, you know, and the quality of the standards you're using or the regulatory approach you're using. And at the end of it, you really have to be able to justify every step of the process when it comes to calculating something, you know. And there is a lot of BS in cyber. It's just because it's kind of a Wild West practice. But, yeah, that's part of it. I think that's part of its appeal, too, is it's so crazy. You know, when you walk the floors at security conferences, you know, you have people in spacesuits walking up to you. You have people shooting lasers at you. You know, everyone's claiming to be doing something completely unique. There's an element of, you know, it's a very dynamic space. But from our point of view, you know, there's been a lot of really good work done in cyber. And one of the main problems in cyber is that it, you know, that sometimes the good tools and the good approaches that are out there don't get used enough. So we're really more about, you know, relating best practices to each other and doing it in a transparent way, and then adding automation and, you know, AI where it's appropriate, which is in sort of limited use cases, and to enrich that data. So I, you know, when our competitors go out and claim to be doing something, you know, something totally unique and totally new that they won't talk about, you know, if you pressure them, we just keep plodding forward, because we'll talk about anything we're doing, any kind of process calculation or standard, anything. It's right there out in the open.
Okay, excellent. Now, when you do a cyber risk assessment, whether it's qualitative or quantitative or even both, I'm assuming you prepare like a final report for the C-suite or to the IT security manager. To what level of detail do you actually showcase to them in your report? Do you get into like the degree of multicollinearity or Durbin-Watson adjusted R-scores and all that, or you just kind of bring it down as to what they say, reducing it to the ridiculous? How deep do you go with that, or how macro do you go with that?
Right. Well, we can go as far as we need to go, right? If the request is for a drill down, right? So if they want to see, you know, the statistical methods that are used, we're perfectly willing to talk about that. But that is not often the case. And when it comes to presenting cyber risk to the investors or to the board or to the C-suite, they're not going to try and hang you up on the wall for one statistical method or another. That's really not where their heads are at. They want to understand what could possibly happen, right? And how can we either live with that, accept it, or mitigate it? And if we can mitigate it, what are our options? And what are the cost profile of each option? What does it look like in terms of the lessening of exposure? So, you know, we really operationalize actuarial data. We say, this is what's happened historically. This is what we allow our users to sort of say, these are our top risks. We help them with that. Then we take the assessment level, the maturity, because that's a concept, a maturity that's, you know, widely accepted across American business and international business, so it's well understood. And we say, you know, basically, here's what's out there in the wild. Here's what could get us. Here's how we think about that, and here's what we think our exposures are. And, you know, we have to have a presentation layer at the top of the software that is there for the executives to kind of understand the practice. You know, when it comes to the actual modeling itself, like I said, there's a lot of different approaches. And we have several in system ourselves, and probably the future of that might involve, you know, allowing for any number of approaches, because you can do multi-threaded calculations of risk, you know, because Python is a scientific language is so powerful, you know, so you could pick your model, and you know, you could probably even pick whatever model and keep going until it tells you what you want to hear, you know, but people are not really that twisted up about it. They really want to understand what their exposure might look like to the business. And they want to understand cyber in the context of the business, which I think that's what the market has kind of settled on lately. And that's, you know, it has a lot to do with the SEC about to come live with a set of regulations around how governance regards cyber. So, the R&D side I love, of course, because that's my background. But we don't really want to bog down decision makers with, a discussion of whether, you know, random forest is a good approach for modeling actuarial data or, you know, anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Well, when I was doing my master's in agribusiness economics back at SIU, we used mainframe SAS at the time, actually.
Sure.
And that was very cumbersome, you know, doing all the modeling and everything. But, yeah, I remember those days of SAS. That was like the gold standard of fiscal modeling from what I remember.
My father used to work in the House of Representatives back in the 70s, and they would model the economy on a mainframe in the basement there. And I can still remember that thing, looking at it, spinning away. Those were interesting days.
Okay, yeah, excellent, yeah. So now, to kind of change subjects just a little bit here, there are a lot of data privacy laws that, you know, that have been enacted, you know, like the GDPR, CCPA, HIPAA's been around for a long time. How do clients use your services to come into compliance with those data privacy laws?
Yeah, they do it more or less the same way that they do it with respect to other standards. So if they have the bandwidth in terms of the internal resources, they go out and they look at each requirement, right? And they answer the questions. They call up the responsible parties, or they have meetings with the responsible parties. That could be consultants that go in and do it as well. What we try to do is to make that process as seamless as possible. So we try to have all the information they need in system, additional help in the form of, you know, say, supplemental guidance. We try to minimize the amount of clicks they would have to make. When it comes to privacy, it maybe hasn't landed here as hard as it has in Europe, but those days are coming. And, there's going to be some unification because, it's probably not practical to have 50 different standards for 50 different states, right? So, our approach to GDPR, and a lot of clients use our GDPR requirements and system, is the same as any other standard, really. And that's why we're so flexible with respect to what you can put in system. You know, you can put in anything, really, as a set of standards or questions, and then baseline yourself against it.
Okay, excellent. Well, what are your, off-the-cuff questions, what are your thoughts about centralizing at a federal level all these data privacy laws? So instead of having 50 different privacy laws for 50 different states, how about if we create the Department of Cybersecurity and just have something from a top-down approach? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on that are, Senator Ron Wyden and a few others have tried to advance some legislation in that area. It's an idea whose time has probably come. But when it comes to regulation and standards in the federal government, you have a lot of competing interests, right? So you will have K Street, you'll have the lobbies. They often are there, corporations will tell their, lobbyists, talk to the legislators and tell them, this is going to cost a lot of money for us. And, we would prefer if they'd let us handle, these issues ourselves, right? This is an old story in cyber and in compliance and regulation. And it's the same for privacy as well. But that said, you can kind of see where Europe has gone with GDPR and their enforcement bodies over there. And the fine structures over there. The fine structures in California are really different than the fine structures in Europe. But Europe's kind of a little bit more of a legislation-heavy set of societies, right? I mean, historically. So, and they're older, and there's more of a I don't know, what would you call it, a belief or a faith in bureaucracy over there that is not natural to the American system. So I think there's probably some resistance to unifying the data privacy standards, but that it will happen eventually here.
Okay, excellent. Now, how easily do your products integrate with other third-party applications or actually with homegrown systems of your client? Very easily integrated, or is there any customization you have to do or anything like that?
Well, because we're young and pretty agile, I would say it's quite easy. We have APIs set up. We don't have a big SDK or a developer's warehouse or set of documentation, but we do build integrations very quickly here. And we're maturing software, so someday in the future we will have a way for developers to interact with us a little bit more extensively, like you see with a lot of mature software products. If a customer comes with a compelling case for an integration or for an API, we jump on it.
Okay, excellent. Well, Patrick, in closing, where do you think the future of cyber risk is going to take us? Are we going to back to AI? Are we going to see this whole thing being propelled by AI, or how we're on the total goal is going to be cyber risk. Everybody says, yeah, it's important, we need it, but nobody really seems to, you know, it kind of becomes a lower priority in the end, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I see a lot of hopeful signs myself, and, you know, and have been doing this now for quite some time, and I see that a lot of the companies we work with, a lot of the services providers we work with, are settling on a set of best practices really around the management of cyber risk. So I think it's a problem. It's well understood. Now it's a question of how much will is there at the top, and by that I mean the board and the C-suite, to get their heads around it in a more systematic way. And I see a lot of appetite there as well. And that, you know, isn't independent of the regulators. It has something to do with the regulators, you know, just like you saw with, say, Sarbanes-Oxley, cybersecurity is now, an area of very active interest for governance. I do think that maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago, it was all still being hashed out a little bit. But I think now I'm very optimistic that we're going to have a set of practices and best practices and metrics around what it means to be doing cyber risk management well. And that's going to include a lot of different approaches, obviously. But I think it's very important for society. Yeah, it's important for society to do it. We understand that it's a huge existential risk, and it's not just a risk for individual companies; it's a risk for the entire society as well. So I'm hopeful that we're making some progress.
Yeah, that'd be excellent. That'd be awesome. Now, finally, Patrick, if someone who's listening to this podcast, they have more questions about cyber risk or they want to talk more about your solutions, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can go to our website and send us a communication, and we'll get right back to them. So go to CyberSync, our website, and there's an area where you can submit a question or, send an email to us, and we'll be right in touch.
That sounds awesome. Patrick, I'd love to have you again on some future podcasts. I think the topic of cyber risk is something that can be talked about in many more sequential episodes. But for right now, we thank
Definitely.
You for your time so much this afternoon.
Real pleasure. Thanks again. Great chat, and we'll talk again soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Take care.
Take care.